From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, life during and after St. Elsewhere, we meet comic and actor Howie Mandel, St. Elsewhere's irreverent Dr. Wayne Fiscus. Also today, I speak with writer Orville Schell. His new book examines China's growing love-hate relationship with Western pop culture and democracy. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has some thoughts on the dying art of operetta, and he reviews a recording of operettas by soprano Renee Doria. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the language of Berkeley, California, half hippie, half yuppie. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. This week's episode of St. Elsewhere is the final one, and with me to take a look back at St. Elsewhere is Howie Mandel. Since the series premiered 6 years ago, Mandel has played Dr. Wayne Fiscus. He's a resident who is still emotionally adolescent and has trouble dealing with authority figures, but is an excellent emergency room doctor. St. Elsewhere has been praised as TV's most innovative hospital series, a show that could tackle subjects like AIDS and rape, but also knew how to make inside jokes about television itself. In addition to playing Dr. Fiscus on TV, Howie Mandel is also a comic. He's done several HBO specials and is currently in the middle of his national Velcro of Love comedy tour. I spoke with Howie Mandel from radio station KUT in Austin, Texas. I asked him if he's sorry to see St. Elsewhere end or if he's glad to be free of it.
No, I'm not glad to be free of it. And yes, I'm very sorry to see it end. It has been, you know, a major part of my life. And I'm also a fan of the show besides being part of the show. So tonight is going to be kind of sad for me. I'm just going to sit at home and watch the tube and let the tears trickle down my face. I won't actually be crying. I'll have somebody standing over me crying so that the tears trickle down my face.
Are you going to watch tonight?
Yes, I will.
How did you first find out that St. Elsewhere was going to end? Were the actors called together and was it officially announced, or did you know before any official word of it?
Yes, we were all called together and taken out on a camping trip. And Norman Lloyd sat us around the fire and said, "Listen, children." There wasn't a ceremony. There was no ceremony. We were just told that, you know, each year we said this will probably be our last year. And then MTM, I know NBC would gladly carry us again, but MTM, the production company, felt that for business reasons, they can make their syndication sale right now. We have enough shows. There are 136 or 37 episodes, and they could sell it, and that's much more lucrative than to pay the price of keeping the show in production. So they told us that this would probably be the last year. I think throughout the whole year, we knew it would be our last year.
Well, you couldn't.
I don't remember the day exactly we were told.
You couldn't have been a resident much longer.
No. No, I couldn't have been a resident much longer. But, you know, they would have moved us on. I'm sure that our writers, I think, are probably the most, and still are, the most creative writers in television and film. So I have no doubt that they would have come up with something creative for us next year.
Once you knew that there was going to be a final episode, were you anxious to find out how your character was going to end up?
Yes. The answer is yes. Would you like me to expand on that?
Sure.
No,
seriously,
yes.
Though, did you go around bugging the writers wanting to know what they had planned for you?
No, never. I would just take it day by day, you know, and as the scripts would come in, I would read them and just, you know, I was anxious, but I would never go and bug the writers. I was only there like 2 days a week or 3 days a week. Any of us were only there 2 or 3 days a week because it was an ensemble cast. And then I would be off doing my comedy or whatever else I was doing at the time. So I didn't bug the writers, but I wanted to know. And I guess if I watched tonight. And then when I got the scripts, I would never read them because that way it would ruin it for me when I watched it on television. So I'm really looking forward to watching tonight and
finding out what happens, right. Howie Mandel is my guest, and he played Dr. Wayne Fiscus on TV, St. Elsewhere. So how do you think your character has changed over the, 5 or 6 years that St. Elsewhere has been on?
Well, I think he's grown up, and I think that besides changing, along with changing and growing up and he was, they really gave the opportunity, and I think to my character in particular, I mean, there was a, they did it to other characters too, to show all different sides of Fiscus. He became very real. We went with him through his growing experiences, his family tragedies, his own personal tragedies, his own death, and watched how these things affected his life and changed him, and how a person becomes a person. So I think by the end of the 6 years, the avid fans of St. Elsewhere really got to know Fiscus. I know I did. And you don't often in this industry, in film and in television, get to see, get to make a character more than just maybe two-dimensional. But he was almost a real person. He was three-dimensional. He was a real person.
Do you have a favorite episode?
Of St. Elsewhere?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. I have one particular episode of The Smurfs that I really like, where Papa Smurf. But in St. Elsewhere, the one where I got shot and went to, and had that out-of-body experience and went to heaven, hell, and purgatory, which was actually Arizona, Pasadena, and Los Angeles.
Now, did you know in advance that was going to happen to you, or did you just get the script and find out that you were going to get shot in it?
That's how it worked on St. Elsewhere. You really didn't know what was going to happen in advance. We were our own audience. You know, every week we would pick up our script and be as surprised as the audience would be in watching things as they did on television.
Well,
so, no, I had no idea in advance that I was going to be shot. And when you got to page 6 and I was shot, I had no idea that I would be coming back or still surviving that wound. I thought that was it.
That's the thing, right? You must
get
my
agent on this.
Exactly. So, fortunately, you just kept reading and find out that you got revived again.
Yes.
I think that that's probably a fear that a lot of people in series television live with, that their character's going to be killed off.
Well, not like the fear that the people in St. Elsewhere had. I think St. Elsewhere, one of its main charms, for lack of a better term, is the fact that we dealt in realism. And in reality, just because you're a main character in your life doesn't mean you can't get sick, die, and leave. And in most series, that you know that the main character is going to survive, no matter what kind of predicament that character gets into within the context of an episode. In St. Elsewhere, just because you were a series regular didn't mean you couldn't get AIDS and leave the show.
You know, if I remember correctly, after the episode that you starred in, you know, where you accidentally got shot and then, you know, died and went to purgatory, not purgatory, to
heaven, hell, and purgatory.
Yeah, thank you. Then I thought the price you had to pay for that was a couple of episodes where you were kind of stuck in bed and only had a couple of lines. Do I remember correctly?
Yes, with my chest hair shaved and taped tubes to my nipples.
A lot of people, anyway, I think, really liked the relationship that you had with your mother, with your mother of the series, you know, within
right.
the series. In last week's episode, your mother is still kind of recovering from your father's death within the series.
Right.
How did you feel about the way she was portrayed? Is it anything? Could you relate to that at all? Is it anything like your relationship with your mother?
Oh, yeah, she was, the typical mother, and very much like my own mother. So, I think Lainey Kazan, who played my mother, is a fine actress. And it was uncanny, the resemblance that she has to my own mother in her character. She doesn't look like my mother because, of course, as everyone knows, my mother's a Puerto Rican Japanese woman. So, but otherwise, she was exactly like my mom, so she did a great job.
Let's talk a little bit about what it's like to work on a weekly show. Let me reintroduce you first. My guest is Howie Mandel, who starred as Dr. Wayne Fiscus in St. Elsewhere.
Do people forget throughout the course of this show who we're talking to?
Oh, people tune. You know how it is in radio. The people, people have very short memories. We have an audience of amnesiacs, Howie. I forgot to mention that to you.
Oh, okay.
And so you have to keep reminding them of what's going on.
I'll just mention my name before every answer, then.
No, what happens is in radio, people keep tuning in, and they're not quite certain, you know, if they tune in the middle.
Howie Mandel if you're tuning in right now.
Thank you.
And this is Howie Mandel if you're tuning in right now. And this is Howie Mandel if you're tuning in right now. Will this end?
As soon as you stop. When you're working on a weekly series, how far in advance do you get your script before it's time to shoot? On St. Elsewhere.
I got it 2 days before we were shooting. But actually, before the episode started shooting, any episode took 7 shooting days. We worked Monday to Friday, and it took 7 days to shoot one episode. So if we started on a Monday, we were finished it the following Tuesday. So we got it 2 days before that show went into shooting, but your character didn't necessarily work the first day. Being part of an ensemble cast of 12 people, on any given episode, you didn't work more than 3 days, 3-4 days at the most, and not full days.
Do you have much time to rehearse?
No rehearsal.
Seriously, like literally none?
Literally none. But it's film. We shot it like a movie, so it was one-camera film. We would come in and set up the scene, and at the beginning, I guess in the first 2 years, major emergency medical procedures were run through a couple of times before we actually shot it, but that was it. You know, and we'd set up the scene and we'd run through it, and then the director would make his changes, and then we'd run through it, and then the camera guy would block it and the lighting guys, and then they'd light it, and then we'd come back and shoot it and do it in about, 4 or 5 takes.
You were working virtually with the same actors from week to week. Do you think that the acting changed as the ensemble got to know each other better?
The acting change? Well, I can't speak for anybody else because I'm fans with everyone on the show, but I think that for me it was one of my first experiences with acting, and it was a fabulous place for me to continually and hopefully continue to better myself, you know, as an actor. I look back at the first year's episodes and it's hard for me to watch myself anytime, but I felt like I was getting better and better and better, and what a school that was to learn in.
You know the hierarchy within the hospital with the doctors on top and the residents, below taking orders all the time and having to measure up. Did that kind of behavior continue off camera? You know, like did the people who played residents hang out together off camera, and the people who played, the doctors hang out together off camera?
Well, really, at the end of each day, Norman Lloyd would take everyone bowling. That's the way it was.
They're right.
Because
that's
was
a joke,
he
right?
He was our league captain. Norm, our league captain. You know what? We didn't actually...
like each other and hang out together. No.
Well, it's not that. I have a couple... I'm very good friends with Stephen First, Ed Begley, and Eric Lonneville.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the guys I socialize with the most from the show. There wasn't really a hierarchy off camera, but it was. We did not work together. We were not all in every episode and every scene. And you may do a scene with somebody once every 3 months, and
right.
That's when you saw them. So as a cast, we didn't really socialize outside of the set. So and we didn't see each other as often as people would think because we didn't work. You know, it wasn't like a 4-camera tape show like everybody on Cheers works together every week and sees each other every week. And I sometimes wouldn't see somebody for 2-3 months.
You had the reputation of being the practical joker of the cast.
Yeah.
So what did you do to earn that reputation?
Oh, I'm constantly doing things. In fact, right now, all this time you thought you were talking to Howie Mandel. This isn't Howie Mandel. This is a close friend of his. He sent me here. And I think I'm getting along pretty good in this interview. What do you think?
We're
talking to Steve Niley, live in Austin, for those people who just tuned in.
Oh, did you ever hang out with doctors to do research for the series? Get a sense of how they behaved?
When I first started, yeah. I used to go to golf courses on Wednesdays.
I keep imagining what it's been like for the past few years for you to get medical examinations. I'm sure the doctors wanted to talk with you about the series as much as they did about whatever, you know, medical problems brought you into the office.
Yeah, it's strange. People think I know a lot more about medicine than I actually know. You know, they see you on TV and they believe it, including doctors. People come up to me and ask me medical questions all the time. And that's pretty strange, isn't it?
Well, I thought we'd spend the second half of our interview on medical questions, but if you think that's a bad idea...
Oh, that's okay. You know what's even stranger? I help these people.
Do you? Is it seriously, do you?
Seriously?
Yes. Have you gotten familiar enough?
Yes, I have saved this week. I think I've saved 9 lives. It was actually 1 cat.
Right.
But...
Did you like medical shows when you were growing up? I'm not sure how old you are and if, like, Dr. Casey and Dr. Kildare were...
How old do I look, honestly?
I'd say around 30.
I'm 32 in a row. How old are you?
I'm 37.
Well, you're only as old as you feel, and when I get a chance, I'd love to feel you.
Oh, please. How did you get to audition for... That's just the kind of adolescent humor that you're known for, Howie Mandel.
Pardon me?
I said that's just the kind of adolescent humor you've become famous for.
Yes, it is.
So tell me how you got to audition for the series. You had no acting experience.
No, I went into MTM to a lady there called Molly Lapata, who was a casting person at MTM, to just meet, a general meeting, because MTM did great comedies. And she said, can you act? And I said, I don't know. And she gave me this piece of a script to read, that's past tense, to read, which had all this medical terminology on it. And I read it, and she said, thank you, that's very good. And I left the office after 20 minutes. And I went home, and I got a phone call from my agent that said, go back to MTM and meet with these producers for this show. This was a Friday afternoon. I went back an hour after I had been to the casting lady and sat in the room again with the casting lady and all these producers in a semicircle, and they had me read that same medical jargon. Halfway through, they didn't even let me finish. They said, thank you very much, and I went home thinking that whatever it was I was up for, I wasn't going to get, because obviously they didn't even want to hear the whole thing. About an hour later, my agent calls me and says they want me to screen test that Saturday, the next day. And I said I couldn't because I was playing the University of Utah. I was going to do comedy there, and I was contracted to do so, and I couldn't. And he told me that there's probably three guys up for the role, and I'll probably lose it, but we'll try something else. And about an hour later, he calls me back and tells me to go down to the network and read for the network. I went down to the network, sat there in front of all these big executives, and they had me read the same thing for them, and then they said, wait outside. And I looked outside, and it was raining outside, and they said, no, just outside the office. And I stood there, and they came out about 10 minutes later and said, see you Monday. And I started that Monday on the first episode of St. Elsewhere.
So you really had to learn how to act on the job.
On the job. But I tell you something, I think I had the best teachers and the best tools to work with in the business.
The teachers being your fellow actors and the directors, things like that?
Actors, directors, mm-hmm. writers. I mean, mm-hmm. but I learned on the job. But I also came with a certain amount of natural ability.
Well, that goes without saying. Well, my guest is Howie Mandel, and he stars as Dr. Fiscus on St. Elsewhere, which is about to end. And he's also a comic, and we're going to talk about his work as a comic when we return from this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Howie Mandel is my guest. You know, it's interesting, St. Elsewhere, although the character you played on St. Elsewhere, or play on St. Elsewhere, or played on St. Elsewhere is...
Or play.
Or, right.
Or played.
Although the character...
No, played.
Although the character is a good doctor, he had a very irreverent...
elephant?
He had a very irreverent side to him. And a kind of adolescent side to him as well, although he matured a lot over the years.
Yes.
Your comedy act is really, I think, very different than the kind of character you play on St. Elsewhere.
I take acting real serious, and I worked very hard on it, and it is nothing, there is no comparison between my comedy and my acting. And acting is a very technical procedure that you work on and hopefully and you concentrate on and hopefully get better and better throughout the years. Whereas my stand-up comedy is just something that I do, and that's just Howie on stage filled with fear in front of a couple of thousand strangers without a real plan of what to do.
Well, for our listeners who haven't seen you perform, I thought I'd play an excerpt from your record Fits Like a Glove so we could get a sense of your comedy act. Here we go.
What do you want? Wait, I'm talking to somebody.
Yeah.
What's your name? I'll call you Sybil. Okay, this will be neat. On the count of three, everybody on the balcony spit on these people. Okay, one, two. They're not laughing anymore. Oh, you got an umbrella.
Well, you're really hyper on stage. Is that a persona or is that
no,
how you just
real.
Ended up being when you started working on stage?
Well, that's just what happens when I start working on stage. You know, that curtain opens and they say my name, my mind goes blank, and I'm standing there with an hour and a half of work to do and no real plan. So the fear kicks in and it makes me a little hyper.
Do you still really get scared when you're performing?
Always. Always. If I couldn't write an act and then do the same act every night, day in and day out. I'd get pretty bored. And wouldn't be. And I think the fear works for me. I just happen to be lucky that my fear is other people's entertainment.
You use a lot of like four-letter words, which we can't repeat on the radio in your act. But I've noticed, at least from your comedy record, that whenever you say one, it gets big laughs. Just like saying one of those words gets big laughs. Does that ever almost depress you? That you know what I mean? That
yeah, you know I sit home depressed.
No. Do you know what I mean? That it should just
but
get
I don't
an immediate
really
laugh
use,
like that.
I mean, that particular night I used a lot of four-letter words, but I don't just use four-letter words, and I don't think you'll find that there's a laugh specifically for the four-letter word, and I don't condone trying to get a laugh just off a filthy word. I mean, if something, or a filthy word, a dirty word, if something's funny, it's funny. And if my mind is just flowing and sometimes that kind of language comes out, and if it comes out, if it's not funny, they don't laugh. And if it is funny, they laugh. But never just specifically for the word, probably for what I'm talking about or the concept I'm working on or whatever. But I don't think I've ever got a laugh just on a dirty word. And I think that those kind of words are heard so frequently now in movies and in writing and everywhere that people have kind of, I don't think they're affected like they were in the days of Lenny Bruce just hearing the words.
You know, one of the things you say a lot in your performances, or at least you used to, is what? And the way you do it almost reminds me of, I grew up in New York, it almost reminds me of how certain beleaguered store owners in New York would behave if you asked them a question about their merchandise or about how a lot of the parents in the apartment building I grew up in used to behave if one of their children asked them a question. I was wondering where it came from for you.
What? I don't know where it came from. It just comes out. I have no idea why I do anything I do and have never really analyzed what I do, and it just came out. I think originally it came out just from not understanding why the audience was laughing when they were laughing.
Mm-hmm.
So when they started laughing at me, I got very self-conscious and was asking them, what are you laughing at? And I think that's where it came from. You know, some nights I don't even say it, and then some nights it comes out. And I figure, you know, it hasn't. To have a plan each night and to kind of decide what I'm going to do really doesn't work for me. So I don't really have a plan, and I don't know, you know. In fact, I just performed last night in San Antonio, and I didn't say what once. I said it seven times. No, I didn't say it. So I don't know. I've also at this point lost track of what the question was. So I'm just...
That's okay.
I'm just floating. I'm just words are just spewing out, but I have no idea what I'm talking about at this moment.
Howie Mandel is my guest. From what I know about you, you sold rugs before you got into comedy, and the first time I heard that, I thought that was something that you just made up. but
why would somebody
make that up?
Why would somebody make up that they were a rug salesman?
I don't know.
No, I didn't make that up. I mean, I could have made up something more glamorous than a rug salesman. No, I owned two carpet stores up in Canada up until 1980. I had two locations, and that's the business I was in up until, well, I sold it at the end of 80, beginning of 81.
So how did
and
you...
And it's the absolute truth.
So how did you get from rug salesman to comic?
Well, I think that goes without saying. I think that's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it?
Of course, right. Obviously. It happens to everybody.
Does it? In 1979, I went down to the Comedy Store as a tourist. I was in California as a tourist and went to the Comedy Store, and it happened to be amateur night. And they said, does anybody want to come up on stage and do something? And my friends coaxed me into going up, and I went up there, and I couldn't tell you what I did, but I did something for 2-3 minutes, and there was a producer in the audience who produced a comedy game show called Make Me Laugh. And when I came off the stage, he said, are you interested in doing television? And I said, of course I am. That's what I'm here for, you dummy. And he hired me to do Make Me Laugh. And I did those while I was on vacation, 3 days worth, which was 15 shows, 5 shows a day. And when they aired, I started getting work and commuted for almost a year back and forth working and being in the carpet business.
You know, one thing I find really interesting about your career is that as a comic, you have this image as a very, like, hyper, loud comic who appeals mostly to, I guess, college-age men. And as an actor, you've been on what's considered, you know, one of the most, you know, like, tasteful, intelligent series that television has ever offered. There's such disparity between the two images.
Well, it brings me a wider audience. That's why I get fat people at my concerts. No, it brings me, you know, it's great to have that kind of exposure in that kind of range. And, you know, the comedy has got a large audience. It's been everywhere from the people who watch The Tonight Show to HBO to kids who watch The Muppet Babies or Gremlins, and no, I did the voices on those, to the avid St. Elsewhere fan, which is a very different person from the other person. And it's been great for me as far as my concerts go, because I draw from both areas. And the audiences do cross over.
So what's in your future now that St. Elsewhere is ending?
Well, I'm going to continue doing what I've been doing, hopefully. I want to act, and I want to continue acting, and I want to continue touring and doing my stand-up comedy. I have a couple of movies in development right now, which have been stopped. We're going to shoot this summer, but we're stopped because of the writer's strike, so that's why I'm staying out on tour right now. And definitely, if not playing in your city, in a city near you. And until the writer's strike is over, then I'll do a couple of films and just reading. I am spoiled now by St. Elsewhere because of the quality of that show. In reading other things, they have to at least meet up with the standards of St. Elsewhere for me to be interested.
So you're going to watch the show tonight?
I will watch the show, and I hope you do too. I hope everyone does.
Okay, listen.
Let's put us in the top 10 on our going out show.
Thanks so much for talking with us, and I wish you the best. And
thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. My guest has been comic and actor Howie Mandel, St. Elsewhere's Dr. Fiscus. And St. Elsewhere is ending, but Howie Mandel's comedy career continues. He's now on his Velcro of Love comedy tour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actress Patty Duke. As a child actress, she won an Academy Award for her portrayal of Helen Keller. She's currently president of the Screen Actors Guild. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. China is undergoing another revolution. This one has as much to do with style as politics. Pop music, bodybuilding, Western movies, all a result of the country's exposure to the West. Coming up, I speak with writer Orville Schell about his new book about China, Discos and Democracy. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording of operettas by soprano Renee Doria. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses how radical politics and upward mobility have combined to create the vernacular of Berkeley, California. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. There will be no deal between the United States and Panama's General Manuel Noriega. Talks aimed at removing Noriega from power broke down today, with Noriega rejecting a U.S. deal at the last minute. Pro-government sources in Panama say the general turned down the administration's plan because it did not guarantee his latest handpicked president would remain in power. Secretary of State Schultz says Noriega's decision to stay in power shows he puts his own interests before those of his country. Schultz delayed his departure for the Moscow summit today because earlier in the day it did appear that a deal was close at hand. President Reagan left Washington today for his fourth summit meeting with Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev. Mr. Reagan is in Helsinki this evening. He'll spend the next 3 days in Finland before flying to Moscow. At a brief White House ceremony, the president reviewed his agenda for the summit. He said he hopes to make progress on a new strategic weapons reduction treaty.
We'll strive to resolve the issues that still stand in the way of our agreement to cut U.S. and Soviet strategic offensive nuclear arms in half. As we make progress, our negotiators will be able to move forward in their work on the draft START treaty.
Human rights and regional conflicts are also on the list for discussion at next week's summit. Mr. Reagan says he wants to create a new relationship with the Soviet Union based on realities, not merely on a seeming relaxation of tensions. For the second time in 3 weeks, Israel has attacked Shiite Muslim guerrilla bases in southern Lebanon. Jim Muir of the BBC filed this report on today's fighting.
According to the Israelis, the main objective of the operation was to clear radical Hezbollah guerrillas from positions in the village of Luwezi, about 2 miles outside the Israeli-designated security zone. But the hostilities spread over a wide area, with Israeli tanks and artillery pounding the wooded hillsides, nearby villages, and main roads, while Muslim guerrillas from both the Hezbollah and its rivals, the mainstream Amal movement, brought up reinforcements and fired back using anti-aircraft guns and multiple rocket launchers. Amal announced that during the afternoon, its fighters shot down one of the Israeli helicopter gunships which were involved in the attack. Israeli warplanes also carried out bombing raids in support of the advance by the South Lebanon Army militia towards Luwezi. There were conflicting reports from the two sides about the course of the fighting. The SLA announced that it had captured Luwezi, while the Muslim militias said fighting was still going on as night fell.
Jim Muir in Nicosia. 8.5 years after its soldiers marched into Afghanistan to support a Marxist regime, the Soviet Union today finally revealed the extent of the war's toll on the Red Army. More than 13,000 Soviet troops died and another 35,000 have been wounded, that according to official Soviet statistics released today. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The casualty figures were announced 1 week after Soviet troops began their withdrawal from Afghanistan under an agreement signed last month in Geneva. Soviet General Alexei Lisachev, who read the statistics to reporters today, refused to say how many Soviet troops served in Afghanistan. Western analysts say the force numbered about 115,000 at the beginning of the withdrawal, which is to be completed in 9 months. First Deputy Foreign Minister Yuli Vorontsov told reporters that the Soviets might leave military advisors in Afghanistan if the government in Kabul requests them. The Reagan administration has said that the presence of military advisors would violate the Geneva Agreement. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The nation's trade deficit showed a sharp improvement for the first quarter of 1988. The Commerce Department reported today that record export sales helped the deficit plunge to $35.9 billion in the first 3 months of this year. Futures-related selling late today wiped out earlier gains on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1 point in mixed trading to close at 1961.37. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new compact disc reissue of the French soprano Renée Doria singing operetta. Operetta falls between opera and musical comedy, and it's an art form that Lloyd fears may be dying.
In a batch of review copies, I found a new CD on the Borg label of vocal music I didn't remember requesting. In fact, I hadn't even heard of the singer, Renée Doria. At least, that's what I thought. But I was intrigued by the recording dates, practically the only information given on the liner notes. The selections were recorded in France between 1944 and 1970. I played the CD and I was enchanted. These were operetta arias and scenes, some familiar to me, some not. The voice was light, technically skillful, and above all, charming, funny, and insouciant. It took the music seriously without taking itself seriously. Renée Doria had a pretty voice, but the most beautiful voice in the world shouldn't attempt operetta without a flair for its special comic style. And Renée Doria had style. This style includes a mixture of sophistication and innocence, not broad camping or burlesque. It has an undercurrent of sincerity, however lightweight the music may be. And it usually means the singer must be a native of the country that has produced the music. In these days of easy international communication and jet lag, national borders are disintegrating, and this could mean the death of operetta. How can a singer convey the France of Jacques Offenbach and the Vienna of Johann Strauss without inheriting it by direct descent? In trying to find out about Renée Doria, I discovered that not only had I actually heard her before, but I had admired her greatly. She sang the mechanical doll Olympia in the wonderful old Columbia Opera Comique recording of Offenbach's Tales of Hoffmann. Perhaps because her name was somehow omitted on the album cover, I didn't remember it. But I was flooded with pleasure to recover her. She is apparently alive and well, but she retired from singing shortly after the last cuts on this CD were recorded. Here is Renée Doria singing one of my favorite operetta numbers from one of Offenbach's most delectable bits of foolery, the letter aria from La Pericole. One of the rare delights of this album is that along with the Offenbach and Messager and Reynaldo Hahn, Renée Doria also sings Lehár and Strauss, which she does with equal verve and delicacy. So here is Renée Doria in another familiar operetta, but one you don't often get to hear with a French accent, Franz Lehár's La Veuve Joyeuse, better known in this country as The Merry Widow.
Oh,
One of the loveliest surprises is that age never damaged Doria's voice. Perhaps it darkened over the quarter century represented in these selections, but more often than not, it's only the sound quality of the original recordings that gives away how early or late they were actually made.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed René Doria Sings Operetta on the French label Borg, distributed in this country by Qualiton Imports. This is Fresh Air. China's new open-door policy has opened the door to capitalism, pop music, Western movies, fashion, cosmetic surgery, and luxury golf resorts. China's love-hate relationship with the West is the subject of Orville Schell's new book, Discos and Democracy. Schell has been reporting from China off and on since 1975. He's written several books, as well as articles for such magazines as The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Rolling Stone. In Discos and Democracy, Schell offers many examples of how China is changing. One of them is an article he saw in the China Daily, headlined, "Don't Be Afraid of Democracy." I asked him about the point of the article.
Well, I think the point was that when this article appeared in China, it was during this amazing few months when, in 1986 in the fall, when people throughout China were just sort of bubbling with this discussion about the role that democracy might play in Chinese life. So this was a kind of an expression of this wonderful coming alive, this warming up of the political climate.
Yeah, and the article said that, you know, in the past democracy had been equated with bourgeois values, but we shouldn't completely dismiss democracy.
Well, you know, it's sort of a whole package: democracy, capitalism, you know, pop culture, and the Chinese have long had this sense, or this hope, perhaps would be a better way to put it, that you could kind of borrow discreetly from the West, that you could borrow technology or borrow aspects of an economic system, and that you wouldn't have bled into this discrete borrowing all these other values and ideas. And, of course, many other things have drifted into China along with such new ideas as democracy. And the Communist Party doesn't quite know how to deal with it, whether to try to banish them, to accept them, to take off pieces of them. And it's this welter of new and fascinating and highly seductive ideas, values, music, literature, political notions that have now just entered what once was a kind of a very one-dimensional situation.
I think one of the main points of your book is that when China opened its doors to the West, popular culture came in, American popular culture came in. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that it's not always the best stuff that came in. I think one of my favorite parts of your book is you sitting, I think it was on a plane in China, listening to Muzak versions of Vaya con Dios and Puff the Magic Dragon, I Felt for You.
Well, I mean, that's the paradox of freedom, isn't it? I mean, exactly the paradox that communist countries have not wanted to wrestle with and are very ill-equipped to wrestle with, namely that with the good comes the bad. And so at the same time, one can be in China and be horrified by the kind of kitsch that comes in, the worst, for instance, kinds of disco, this kind of knockoff Chinese disco. At the same time, one is sort of electrified by the idea that China is becoming somewhat freer, more open. But when that door opens to the West, even a crack, I mean, it's like a tidal wave crashes in. And, you know, the difference between now and China and 10, 12, 15 years ago is that whereas once America was reviled, now it is exactly the opposite. It is the symbol of everything wonderful, exciting. But, of course, the slavish worship and this creating a fantasy of the West is just as sort of unrealistic as creating the opposite fantasy of the United States as a pit of bourgeois values and United States as the imperialist, capitalist enemy of the masses of the world.
When the first few times you went to China, there were a lot of political songs and political slogans that were used, and you make it seem like a lot of those have disappeared. But maybe you can... You'll hate me for this. Would you sing one of the political songs that used to be really popular?
Oh, I that's amazing. You know, I wish I actually... Somebody ought to collect these songs, you know, that songs about all the followers of Chairman Mao being little sunflowers. And there's one wonderful song called Socialism is Good. And this is just a wonderful song because it's so simple. And it's so... You talk to Chinese now about the days when they were singing these songs and they kind of laugh uproariously, and yet they were involved in it. You know, it was an era where there was no ambiguity, where people were unambivalent about what was happening. They were surging forward with these wonderfully defiant and uncomplicated looks of sort of socialist ardor on their face. But, you know, alas, that era is over, and China has been thrown into a three-dimensional universe once again, where people are forced to deal with all the complex questions that everyone else in the world is forced to deal with. And I think there's going to be a big nostalgia industry in China soon for those days when things were uncomplicated, people believed, values were clear, and the revolution hadn't canceled itself, you know, with all these leaders indulging in intrigues and power struggles and leaving the country just sort of bereft of belief and quite cynical.
You know, one of the things I find interesting about China is that it's become this place for people to project their fantasies. Those fantasies might be about the perfect egalitarian society, or about the Red Menace, or about spiritual wisdom, but everybody seems to have something to project onto China. Do you find that yourself?
Yeah, I think it's very true. I mean, we look back to the 60s, where in this country in Europe, I mean, during all the student uprisings, people had really did take China as a model. And that's because, theoretically speaking, it makes a lot of sense. What we missed, of course, was the way in which that revolution was failing to deliver on the theory. I think it's true also in this kind of cosmic sense that people love to imbue China with this idea of being the spiritual, deeply spiritual land. In fact, I can't think of any country in the world right now which is sort of less spiritual than China. And I think that's one of the sad facts of the Chinese Revolution, that in turning on old culture, it not only destroyed traditions of the past, but it also canceled China's identity. So people in China have a very little sense about not only what to believe in, but who they are, what it means to be Chinese. And I think it doesn't bode well for the future, because any country which sort of loses its mooring and tries to reestablish some sense of itself by borrowing and casting around is a highly unstable one. And in the meanwhile, it allows us from the West to project to it whatever we wish, since it is, in a sense, nothing clear and anything and everything to anyone who wants to make it so.
Are you glad that you can go to China in the capacity of a book author and journalist, and that you can write in a fairly breezy first person kind of style about it, as opposed to a more formal analysis of the politics and economy of China?
Yes, because I think if there's anything China has lacked, and the Chinese Revolution has lacked, it's the kind of a notion of it as a country which is made up of people whose lives are, you know, triumphs and tragedies. We've had so much of China as political movements, as sort of sociological phenomena, and it's been such a difficult country to get to know in any deeply personal way. So that I try always to somehow convey that sense and not just treat it as a board game of, you know, sides washing back and forth across the country waged in sort of political combat.
Have your experiences in China influenced the way you live in America?
Well, I'll tell you, I think they have in the sense that I find myself ever more appreciative of what the kinds of lives that we are able to live here, both from the standpoint of the enormous wealth we have, but also, and I really underline this, the incredible freedom we have. I think, you know, finally it's this that is so seductive about us. And I wish that the people in Washington, that the powers that be, would understand how powerful we actually are as a model, you know, as a kind of seductive culture, as a political system that really needs no Marines, needs no, you know, military actions to persuade others. Once Nixon went there and China began to get a glimpse of the West, the rest followed almost automatically until now we're in the embarrassing situation of not needing to sell ourselves anymore, but in fact warning the Chinese, you know, slow down, you know, don't go too far overboard, find your own balance, don't be too ready just to grab everything Western.
So you think rock and roll and movies have more power than the U.S. military, huh?
Oh, boy, I think that is the understatement of the century.
Well, Orville Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Orville Schell's new book, Discos and Democracy, is published by Pantheon. He spoke to us from station KQED in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's up?
For the second time this year, Israel has attacked Iranian-backed Hezbollah militia positions in Lebanon, and we'll have a report on that and including what that means. Also, a review of the U.S. policies and actions towards Panama that have led to the current crisis there. The trouble, according to our analysis, is that may have been sort of a rare phenomenon in Washington. It may have begun with that, and that's too much agreement. And also, Terry, even as we speak, Robert is out testing out a phenomenon known as the hot hand. That's a cherished theory that a basketball player will make more shots the more shots he makes.
Well, we'll see what happens. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the 60s, the city of Berkeley, California, was the home of the free speech movement. Along with free speech came new countercultural and political expressions. Our San Francisco-based language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg updates the lingo of Berkeley.
In most of the country, people tend to think of California as a vast, undifferentiated bin of loonies, just as they think of California wine as a single variety. But when you live out here for a while, you become something of a connoisseur of craziness, so that you can distinguish among all the subtle flavors that dottiness acquires when it takes root in different soils. A couple of years ago, Syra McFadden's novel The Serial gave us the definitive description of the language of the New Age culture that flowers among the BMWs and hot tubs of Marin County, just over the Golden Gate Bridge. Now, R. Howard Block has done a similar service for the city of Berkeley. His new novel, Moses in the Promised Land, is a caustic tour of the people, the politics, and the language of a city that even we San Franciscans sometimes contemplate with a sense of wonder. It's been said that Berkeley is the only city in the United States with its own foreign policy. Other towns have sister cities like Frankfurt or Osaka, but Berkeley is more likely to declare its sorority with occupied towns in El Salvador or with the Gaza Strip. It's a city that's decided to bail out of America and take the language over the side along with it. The local patois had its origins in the free speech movement and in 60s radicalism, but over the years, it has accommodated itself to psychobabble and yuppie talk without ever losing its basically political cast. Block has done a wonderful job of capturing the language of Berkeley, the consumers who argue over which croissants are nutritionally correct, the exterminator who urges his customers to preserve the tranquility of your home through the sensitive rehabilitation of unwanted insect species. Or listen to how one of Block's characters describes her work at an ecological trauma center. I had a draining day. We saw several of the families from Bay Point who discovered they were living on a toxic dump. They're very decompensated. We're working to help them learn to trust the environment again with some pretty heavy ecological role play. Moses in the Promised Land is a satirical novel, of course, but it's not as broad as it might sound to someone who has never experienced Berkeley firsthand. This is a place, after all, where the bulletin boards are full of announcements for workshops in nonviolent jujitsu and support groups for recovering Catholics, and where financial planners invite prospective customers to attend prosperity consciousness discovery groups. The extraordinary thing about the language of Berkeley is the way it tries to encompass the martial radicalism of the old counterculture and the kickback consumerism of the new counterculture, that is, the culture of cheese counters, bread counters, and so on. It's a contradiction we've all had to come to terms with, of course, but Berkeleyites remain militant in their mellowness and intransigent in their tolerance. Berkeley is the kind of place where consenting adults can do anything they like in the privacy of their own bedrooms, so long as they don't try to smoke afterwards. The politicization of the good life is nicely captured in one of my favorite lines from Moses in the Promised Land, where a psychiatrist assures the hero that Berkeley is the spot where the Constitution's promise of happiness will be fulfilled. As he puts it, the beauty of this city is that the time and place has come where lifestyle is open to all.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. On the next Fresh Air, I'll talk with singer Helen Merrill. Her new record is one of Gil Evans' last collaborations. It features the same songs and arrangements they recorded together 30 years ago. We'll compare the two records and see how Helen Merrill's singing has changed. Rock critic Ken Tucker will review two new rap albums, one by Run DMC and the other by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, a new group whose rhythms and rhymes build on the innovations of the first rappers. And guest film critic Michael Schrago will review Willow, the fantasy adventure film by Ron Howard and George Lucas. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.